What does Jesus teach us about death and resurrection? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host, professor in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. My conversation partners are Paul Dibdall and Dave Thomas, also from the School of Theology. We're continuing our discussions on the teachings of Jesus, and the specific teaching for this lesson is death and resurrection. So, brothers, what does Jesus teach us about death and resurrection? Maybe we should start with death to start with.
Well, one thing that comes to my mind very quickly is that death is an enemy.
And how do we know that from the story of Jesus?
He sets about to reverse death. He raises people from the dead. So I think that would be an indication mm-hmm. that death is not a state that is something forward to.
Your question surprised me. Did he not say as much, that death is an enemy? But no verse is coming to mind, so I'm doubting myself.
Well, 1 Corinthians 15, I think, is the one that deals with death and resurrection most directly. But I'm just thinking of the teachings of Jesus and what Paul suggests here. We've got at least two resurrections from Jesus, don't we? The widow's son and Lazarus.
What about
Jairus' daughter?
Jairus' daughter, yeah. Right. Okay, so there's at least three.
What about the centurion's? Did the centurion's servant die or no?
It was on the verge of death, I think, is what
But then you said, what did he tell us about death and resurrection? And he tells us that the resurrection is the antidote to death.
Yeah. And in fact, in the story of the raising of Lazarus, I think it is Martha who says he will live again.
Yes, she does. And by the way, I want to say a word about Martha. You know, Martha gets a lot of bad press because of her incident of caring for everybody while Mary did the nobler thing. But in that particular section, they're talking about that Martha shows up as an early believer in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess, you know, the question, what does Jesus tell us about death? It seems to me that if I were to try to summarize it, Jesus, through his life, his example, would tell us that death is not the final word, mm-hmm. that's not the last thing that there is to be said, but that there's something beyond that that Jesus makes possible. Mm-hmm. He is, as he said, I'm the resurrection and the life.
Mm-hmm. And so, Paul, what fascinates me is that all humans, it seems to me, do not like the idea that our existence or our consciousness simply ends and it's over. You look at almost any thought system, except for nihilists and maybe rank secularists, there is some hope that our sense of consciousness and personhood, our existence will continue. And I like the Christian version of that story.
Yeah, and I particularly like the words of Paul, because you don't have hard proof for this, because nobody's ever been that. But for in hope we were saved. A hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience.
Yeah.
Christians live in hope of something mm-hmm. better.
Yeah. And to add what I said earlier about death not being the final word, Jesus also describes death as a sleep, and I think that's probably important for us to consider as well. I think Jesus' view of what happens when a person dies is somewhat different than maybe even the dominant Christian view today. And I say that not to stir up trouble, but just as an observation.
Yeah, and you know, I've thought about that. I remember as a kid once going to bed, I was very tired. I don't know what we've been doing, but I was extremely tired. And I fell asleep before my head hit the pillow, so to speak. And the next thing I knew, the sun was shining in the window. And the next morning, I'd had no sense of the passage of the night. And I've always thought that if death is in fact asleep, that's probably what it's like. You'll go to sleep and wake up in the morning.
Mm. Now, if we place this in the larger scene of the Old Testament, sometimes very devout conservative Christians like to see things all equally clear everywhere in Scripture. But I don't think you can really demonstrate that from Scripture. For example, where does Abraham go when he dies? Gathered to his
fathers.
And the Old Testament picture of Sheol which is the underground. It's
The grave. It's the grave.
It's the grave.
Place where dead people go. Right. So,
and everyone goes there, the right. good and the bad.
Right.
And the Old Testament word, one of the Old Testament words for dead people is Rephaim, shades. And if you go to Isaiah 14, it's really amazing. It's the story of Lucifer being, or the king of Babylon, the prince of Babylon, being brought down below. And when he gets there, oh, it's you. It's really a very dramatic passage there in Isaiah 14. You know, maggots are your bed, you see. And there's no sense of communication, but it's certain. In fact, you're cut off from everything that happens in the world. By the time you get to the book of Daniel, then it is clearly there's a clear statement of resurrection.
Yeah, there is one.
Yeah. But it doesn't really come clear until after the resurrection of Jesus that all God's people will expect resurrection. All those who have gone asleep in Jesus will come alive. Now, if we look at death furthermore, there's a very interesting historical perspective here in the last 100 years or so, well, less than the last 100 years. Oscar Kuhlmann wrote a little book mid-century. He's at that time was a well-known New Testament scholar, and he contrasted the philosophy, the Greek philosophy, with the Christian perspective, and pointed out that the natural follow-through for the doctrine of creation is a doctrine of resurrection, because the created world is good and will be restored. The doctrine of the immortality of the soul assumes that the body is evil and will be left aside. And what he does is contrast the death of Socrates, who was a Greek philosopher, drank the hemlock juice willingly because his soul now would be liberated from its prison here on earth. Whereas Jesus, when he faces death, it's with strong crying and tears, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? So from
wow,
that...
Wow, that's a remarkable thought.
From that point... after Kuhlmann's publication, and he says he got more response to that than all his other scholarly works together, and it's just a smallish book published in the 50s, the discussions of hell in scholarly circles virtually died. You couldn't find anyone who was willing to get up and argue in favor of eternally burning hell. Now, you've got, in the past, Augustine, for example, he actually believed that you needed a hell. So that when heaven got boring and you could go look over the walls of New Jerusalem and see those people writhing down there, oh, that's why we're here. So, but in the modern scholarly perspective, finally at the end of the century, hell has come back with some strong defenders. But from the standpoint of believers, I think to speak well for God, and even within the Adventist community, there is this amazing perspective of Ellen White doing 180 degrees, and it's incredibly difficult if you've grown up believing that your relatives are up there in heaven looking down on you. All of a sudden, to see those people gone, that's incredible. And the motivation factor, too, is a key one, see? If you can.
But, of course, if your relatives can see what's happening on earth, heaven may not be such a happy place.
Oh, it would be a miserable place. You know, to see all the disasters going down here, it's just really not happy at all. So.
But that's a remarkable juxtaposition, Socrates and Christ, because, you know, it does, Kuhlmann, I think, is right, is that there is a tension in the Christian world between these two foundational ontologies, that where the there's a differentiation between a good soul and a bad body. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, then death actually could be seen as a liberation from your
body.
That's
right.
I don't think that's a biblical notion.
The creation, it was good, see, and that's where Kuhlmann says resurrection assumes that the body is good and be restored.
Yeah.
Now, there's one troublesome passage that I think we ought to spend a little bit of time. Rich man and Lazarus, Luke 16, 19 to 31. And if we are to look at that one, there is the rich man who didn't spend a lot of time caring about Lazarus, the poor man outside his gate, and when he died, he ended up going to the wrong place and was in torments there and asked that maybe someone could send Lazarus with some drops of water. What do we make of that story? Anybody want to be brave and tell the truth about that? Luke chapter 16, verses 19 to 31.
Well, you kind of gave us a summary of the story already.
Right. And what's the point?
Should I launch right into it, or you want to work up to it a little bit?
No.
I think the point here comes at the end. One of the rules of parable interpretation is that the end stress of the parable probably gives you an idea of what the primary point ought to be. And this is a parable.
Yeah.
At the end, we find this statement from Father Abraham to the rich man. He says, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. So the point here is that if you are closed off from the way in which God has spoken to you in the past, a miracle, even a miracle as great as a resurrection, is not going to convince someone who mm-hmm. is already convinced otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
What's the old saying? A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. It's that mm-hmm. kind of idea mm-hmm. here.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at this particular story, there's some things that make it very difficult. You know, Lazarus sent some water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, it assumes that the body is well, because how can you have suffering without a body? See, that's an interesting mm-hmm. wrinkle.
But if you take this, if you want to take this as a literal description of what happens when people die, then there are all kinds of problems throughout the story that it just simply doesn't. It begins to not really make sense.
Yeah. And it really makes most sense to build on the Old Testament platform where you go down to Sheol, you're cut off from God, and then when we build with the New Testament, where you have the hope of the resurrection, that's not that clear most of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the New Testament, it comes clear, and then you look forward to restoration at the time of the second coming.
But I think the story, the opening verse is telling, too, that there once was a rich man. That's kind of like once upon a time story.
Yeah. So. He was dressed in purple. At his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, and so on.
Yeah.
And that ties in some other interesting stories of Jesus, you know, the sheep and the goats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what have you done to help the poor Lazarus at your gate?
Yeah, it's also a call to be mindful of those that are suffering around us.
Yeah.
That has eternal consequences.
Yeah. Now, next week we will bring this sequence to a close with a focus on the second coming. And Paul and Dave will be my conversation partners. I want to thank our program engineer, David Olson, and all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.